Okay, so my guest today is Andrew Guthrie Ferguson. Andrew is a professor at the David A. Clark School of Law at the University of the District of Columbia. Professor Ferguson was formerly a supervising attorney at the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. He worked as a public defender for 7 years, representing adults and juveniles in serious felony cases ranging from homicide to misdemeanor offenses. He now teaches and writes in the area of criminal law, criminal procedure, and evidence. He is an expert on juries, predictive policing, big data and policing, big data and race, and the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. I'd like to welcome you to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure and honor to be here.
So, Andrew, I contacted you specifically about the work you're doing on predictive policing and big data in policing and the various opportunities and challenges that it presents for the criminal justice system. And this interview is obviously taking place as part of this project that I'm conducting on algorithmic governance in various walks of life and the changes and consequences of this increased reliance on algorithmic governance. So I think predictive policing is a good case study on this phenomenon, and it's one that happens to be of great practical significance. And it's also an area of technology that is developing possibly faster than most people realize. Now, we're going to structure our conversation today around one of your more recent articles on this topic, an article entitled Policing, Predictive Policing, which I think came out last year, at least I saw it last year, but it's being published this year in the Washington University Law Review. And I think we'll divide our discussion up into maybe two main sections following the structure of that paper. The first is just a definition and history about what is predictive policing, and then the second half will go into some of the specific vulnerabilities and risks associated with predictive policing that you identify in your paper. So if we go into the first of those topics on what is predictive policing, when I hear that term predictive policing, I guess there are one or two reactions among most people. You can either view it as quite a mundane phenomenon insofar as prediction is part of policing naturally, or a more science fictional or extreme phenomenon, something akin to the scenario sketched, let's say, in Philip K. Dick's short story Minority Report, where you imagine a police force with a pre-crime division that can predict future crimes and arrest those who are going to commit them before they actually do. Now, I love those kinds of science fictional stories because they raise lots of interesting philosophical questions around free will and punishment. And you know, there are questions about whether it's coherent or philosophically plausible to even imagine a system of pre-crime and pre-punishment. But I suspect that we're a long way from implementing those kinds of technologies. And I'm hoping that in this conversation, you can maybe make my imagination a little bit more grounded by telling me exactly what kinds of technologies exist and how they currently operate. I thought I'd open up with a simple question, though, which is just why did you get interested in this particular topic of predictive policing?
Well, thank you very much. I happened to find my way along into predictive policing by starting with a few incidents in our local courthouse. I was a public defender. One of the issues, if you are defending people accused of crime, is whether people are stopped lawfully or constitutionally. And one of the factors that police can consider, according to the Supreme Court here, is whether the stop took place in a high crime area. And lo and behold, every time I seem to be cross-examining a police officer, they testify that my client was in a high crime area, which led me to ask, what is a high crime area? And when all I got as an answer was, it's where I stopped your client, I realized there must be data behind it. And so I started looking into the data. I started looking into whether we could create empirically proven, objective, high crime areas, whether anyone was doing it, which sort of led me into this world of crime mapping and the whole history of crime mapping, which then led me into predictive policing as it bloomed, which led me into big data policing, which has even led me now into what I think will be the next iteration, which is predictive prosecution, the idea of being able to target individuals for prosecution based on the sense that they are the highest risk people in a community. So it sort of has evolved out of my frustration that there was no data behind these claims into an entire scholarly agenda that keeps me employed as a law professor here in America.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think even in what you're saying, we can sense some of maybe the deep history to this phenomenon, that it's maybe not as sudden or unexpected as we might be led to believe if we follow some media stories about it. But maybe you could just start off with a definition of predictive policing. How do you define the phenomenon that you're interested in?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I think that we have seen predictive policing evolve, although, and the definitions sort of encompass different aspects of the same type of predictive analytics that are actually quite different. One of the things I try to do in the paper you reference of policing, predictive policing, is put a little clarity on the fact that we really have different types of predictions that are based on different theories. And yet, because it's such an attractive sort of media story, such an attractive buzzword, we really have been seeing different predictive analytic theories, different capabilities, all lumped into one global term of predictive policing, which has sort of been pushing things. Like, no matter whether you're talking about place-based predictive policing, like particular areas and locations, or person-based predictive policing, people are using the same terminology, which is a bit sloppy in some ways. But part of the reason why we're having this conversation is because it does evoke that Minority Report world. It does evoke the fact that there's new technology and new black box magic that can, you know, solve and prevent crime. That's so attractive that it allows us or causes us to not really look too carefully at the social science underneath it or the science underneath it, which is sort of what I'm pushing back on in my articles and in my thinking.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that kind of gets into then maybe the history behind this, which is something that you pay close attention to in the paper. And one of the questions that I had, and it's an obvious question, is that isn't policing just by nature predictive? Isn't it part of the goal of policing is to preempt and prevent crime? So, you know, where do the use of these predictive risk assessment tools originate from? And how long have they been used in policing?
So, you know, predictive risk assessment tools can be dated back to the 1920s. 1928, I think, was the first time we saw them being used out of the Chicago School to focus on recidivism for people being sentenced. So people in the criminal justice system who are sentenced who might reoffend, there were judges and scholars sort of pushing the idea that we can identify using objective risk assessments who will be most likely to reoffend. And they've developed over time, you know, over the last 100 years to be more sophisticated. What we now know as sort of predictive policing really arose in Los Angeles, California, based on the work of a few social scientists, anthropologists, Jeff Branningham, who created PredPol, which is one of the leading companies about predictive policing. And really, it was their creation, but also their sort of skill in marketing the idea that really created what we now are thinking about of predictive policing. But as you know, the idea of being able to predict where there will be crime and who will be involved in crime is as old as policing itself. And what we have now is simply just a little bit of data and a little bit of good marketing behind it to try to sense that it's something new. But it's actually happening, and there are programs, and there is data that's being turned into algorithms, which is being turned into actual action. So while it is an old theory in the sense of we will always be trying to predict and deter crime, it's also something new that is evolving and is worth watching.
So would it be fair to say that this more recent, newer incarnation of predictive policing, which we'll just refer to as predictive policing from now on, is associated with obviously automated systems or surveillance technologies and big data sets? Is that what's distinctive about the new phenomenon?
It is. That's how it's being marketed, right? So if you take sort of, I call it predictive policing 1.0, the first iteration was this idea of place-based predictions, taking past crime data, and the data, the variables are very limited. It's about past where the crime was, the time of crime, and the type of crime. Just those three variables and looking at past crimes to be able to forecast where there's a greater likelihood of future crimes. And that might sound a little strange, but for certain crimes, and this is what PredPol began with, certain crimes such as burglary and car theft and theft from auto, it turns out that criminals who are committing those crimes tend to be fairly predictable. That what has happened, and this wasn't necessarily PredPol's invention, they realized that there was social science behind it, that, you know, if there is a house that a burglar can burglarize, many houses and neighborhoods are built the same, there's usually some sort of environmental vulnerability that has allowed the burglar to see this as a ripe target. And what happens is people go back. They're like, they even sometimes go back to the same house, but they'll go back. They can break into one house and the next door house is built the same. They go back there. If there are no police around, they'll keep going until sort of the risk factors change. And same thing with car thefts and thefts from auto. These place-based crimes are almost contagious, right? That if there is one, there might be another. And what the first sort of scientists behind predictive policing recognize is they could create a rather, I think, simple in terms of algorithms, so perhaps all algorithms are complicated, a rather simple predictive formula to say this kind of contagion will happen. So if you know there's an uptick of burglaries here, you know what? You should send some police in this area to be able to predict the next burglary. And that's what they did. They created a used a earthquake seismic formula that sort of, as there are repeat patterns in earthquakes that sort of have the aftershocks, they use the same similar math to say there'll be these aftershocks of crimes. They created a program, and then this is where they're success was they sold it to companies, I mean, to police departments, saying we can help you focus where your patrol should be. We'll tell you where you should go. And in doing so, we will deter crime.
Yes. So this is what you referred to as predictive policing 1.0. So it's a focus on place-based crimes like burglary, automobile theft, and other kinds of property-related offense, I guess. And it is also geared around the redistribution or reallocation of policing resources. So it's like how to target effectively the available policing resources in a particular area. So you develop these maps which have hotspots, and the idea is that you target policing in the hotspots in an effort at preventing crime from taking place.
Correct.
Okay. And what's the time frame that we're looking at here? When was this trialed initially by the LAPD?
We're really looking around 2009, 2010, it starts beginning. And then over time, they have been doing sort of experiments in their own ways to see if different divisions could adopt it and could it be successful. And they've been working. I think Predpol, as just one of the many companies involved in this sort of arms race of selling predictive technologies, is in about 60 cities now in America, and there are international operations. They've done experiments in the UK, in Kent, England, and so it has sort of evolved, and they've had competitors. There are different companies. Hunch Lab is one of the companies out of Philadelphia that is doing a similar project, except they use more variables. So they use not just the type of crime and the place and the time, but they'll use weather patterns, time of days, other things that might be going on in the community, which could shape a crime. So, for example, something as simple as many employers still pay people on Fridays, right? So if everyone payday is a Friday, and you want to see rob someone, it's better to rob them after they got paid than before they got paid. And so those sort of small vulnerabilities, and also weather, can shape things. So they have a more sophisticated, in their version, algorithm that's sort of doing the same sort of predictive of policing.
Yeah, this just reminds me of something I remember reading years ago about whether more crimes took place when the moon was full. Mm-hmm. And the data suggests that more crimes do take place when you have a full moon. And some people argue that this is because the moon had some effect on our psychology. It caused people to act out in more criminal ways. But then I guess the more sensible explanation is that more people commit crimes when the moon is full because it's just easier to see things taking place right at night. Anyway,
And that insight, though, is something that is underlying a lot of predictive policing, right? There is an entire library filled of criminology studies that show that environmental risk factors create crime, right? That the people who are out there committing crimes are doing it in a quasi-rational way. They're looking for vulnerabilities, they're looking for targets. And that if you study the environment, you'll see where the intersection is most likely to create a crime. And what predictive policing is doing is sort of trying to quantify that, like crunch the numbers to figure out if they can isolate where there are riskier areas. One of the more interesting innovations that I've seen is coming out of Rutgers with this organization, these two academics who have created something called risk terrain modeling. And what they do is they look at, it's still place-based predictive policing, but they look at environmental risk factors that might be surprising to you. Things like the correlation between bus stops and laundromats and 24-hour stores and other sort of geographic landmarks. And they overlay in their sort of risk terrain maps in this model these areas. And they can show that there are certain places where it's more likely to be crime. And they've been very effective in showing it. And so you'd say, okay, why would there be a higher crime somewhere near a laundromat, a vacant lot, and a convenience store? It doesn't make sense. And then they come up with the why, which is that if you want to deal drugs, you go to the convenience store to find out where the drugs are being sold. You go do the deal in the laundromat because no one can see you there. And then you, because you don't want to carry the drugs and the money at the same time, you end up in the vacant lot. And of course, that's the place where people might take advantage of you. You might get robbed, you might get shot, all the rest of it. And so there's a story behind these sort of fixed environmental risk factors that when they overlap, increase crime and increase risk, I guess. And that is sort of the insight behind all that can be quantified and seen through data. And those maps and these ideas are sort of the engine behind why predictive policing might work.
Yeah, you mentioned just one thing earlier on, but when this started, when this phenomenon began in this modern incarnation in 2009. So, you know, one obvious thing about that date is that it came shortly after the Great Recession began. So to what extent is the implementation of this technology being driven by economic necessity or a belief that this is a cost-cutting or cost-effective measure?
I think it's a real factor. So I just finished up a book called Black Data Policing that has as its sort of thesis that the reason why we're seeing this embrace of big data policing, that's an even broader term than predictive policing, is a combination of the recession in America at that time, where police departments across the board had to do more with less, had to look for new innovations, and still had to answer to the political entities who said, what are you going to do to stop this crime problem? And they needed an answer. And one of the greatest answers, the best answers they could give was, well, we have this new technology. You know, like many things in life, you can do more with less if the technology supports you. And so it's a terrific talking point. Whether it worked or not didn't matter, because it was a response to the age-old question of what are you going to do? And the second was, we've seen a lot of tension and uproar in America between police and communities over race relations. There's been a series of shootings, police shootings of unarmed African-American men. There have been protests and riots in various areas. And there's a need to sort of turn the page into something that feels less biased, right? And even though data and the data underlying the predictive policing can have many of the same implicit and explicit biases baked into it, it's also a good response to say, you know, we are moving away from what happened in the past to something new and futuristic. So don't worry about it. And you should worry about it, but that's a great talking point. So those two things, I think, are really pushing the engine toward why this is being adopted. It's both cheaper. It's not to say cheaper, but it seems cheaper because you have to actually respond to the fact that you've lost officers on the streets, and it's a response to some of the political and racial tension and upheaval in America right now, where, again, police chiefs need an answer to say, what are you going to do that's different than the past, because the past hasn't been working.
Okay, now there's one thing I don't want to lose sight of. You mentioned that in your paper you have these three different stages in the evolution of predictive policing, 1.0 to 3.0. I think we've got a good sense of what 1.0 is, but could you maybe explain the differences between predictive policing 2.0 and 3.0?
Sure. So, you know, predictive policing 1.0 is not just only place-based predictive policing, but place-based predictive policing on three types of crime: burglary, theft from auto, and car theft. Important crimes in your daily life, but obviously there are a lot of other crimes, right? And what happened was there was pressure to evolve the technology, even though the underlying theory and even though the limited social science work had been done on those sort of three types of crime, the pressure was, well, that's great, but can you stop shootings? We don't want shootings to happen. Can you stop robberies? We don't want robberies to happen. So predictive policing 2.0 is sort of the evolution to do place-based violent crimes, and trying to adapt the technology and the theory that was used in place-based property crimes to violence. Now, the problem was there isn't the same kind of data and studies to show that. Maybe there's some correlation. There are certain places where there could be correlation, which we can talk about, but it's not as tight as the place-based predictive policing. And then predictive policing 3.0 involves not place, but people. The idea that we can target individuals and say, you, person, are at risk, and we are predicting that you will be at risk. And we've seen this most often in terms of the public notice and press about it in Chicago, because Chicago Police Department has been taking the lead in developing what they call their heat list. It's called a strategic subject list, where they now have 1,400 young, primarily young men, and I think almost all young men of color, who they believe are most at risk for either shooting someone or being shot. And they have come up with an algorithmically determined list. It's created by a social scientist at ITT, Miles Wernick. And they have created this list to determine who are the people who are most at risk of being shot or shooting someone. And then they're adapting their policing policy to target those young men, either through social interventions of, you know, and we can talk about exactly what they're doing, of giving them options, or social surveillance to know that these are the people who are most likely to be involved in crime and that they're going to be watching and waiting for them.
Yeah, so there, you mentioned there's a very different set of values or ethical risks associated with that shift from the place-based targeting to the person-based targeting. Could you maybe explain what those different risks are?
Sure. I mean, so there are both risks in confusing sort of the initial success of predictive policing 1.0 as being relevant to determine whether predictive policing 3.0 would work, whether just because you can predict the next burglary because houses are built the same and the property are the same, does that mean you can predict the next individuals? And the answer is no. There's other social science behind why and how predictive policing 3.0, the person-based predictions, came up. And it's sort of looking at social network theory, recognizing that a lot of crime, especially in Chicago, is interpersonal and interrelational and gang-based, and that the networks of people who are going to either shoot each other or be shot are actually fairly small. They're and interconnected. So you can identify who the people are most likely to be, and it is accurate to say they are more at risk than other people who are not involved in those sort of social networks. Now, the danger is that it is one thing to change your police patrols to go into a particular neighborhood or a particular block, which is predictive policing 1.0, and to actually go literally knock on the door of someone who is predicted to be involved in a crime in predictive policing 3.0. And that's what Chicago was doing. They basically would send a senior law enforcement person, maybe a detective, some sort of supervisor, along with a social worker and someone from the community to knock on the door of someone who had been identified on the heat list and say, knock, knock, knock. Look, we have an algorithm that has put you in the crosshair to say you are either going to get shot or shoot someone. And guess what? We know about you and we know about this risk. There are options. If you want to have some social services, if you want to sort of take the other door, that's great. But know that we know you're involved. And if you don't, we are going to bring down the hammer of law enforcement against you because you've been warned. And this is the way the predictive policing 3.0 sort of worked out in Chicago, where there's this quasi-public health approach, where on one hand, you know, identifying people who are at risk of getting shot makes a lot of sense to warn them, and offering them social services is terrific. But on the other hand is the recognition that this was really a law enforcement protocol. And what the not so veiled threat was is if you should, you know, slip up, we are going to bring the hammer down. And that has happened. People who have been on the list, and as might not be surprising to anyone who studies this, the whole social services part wasn't funded to the level it should have been. And so it sort of looks like the heat list has been used more for a targeting of arrest and suspect list than it has been for really trying to do the public health approach, which was the original idea. And it's not, it's a rational idea. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, there are a couple of things here that I just want to focus on for a moment. One, I mean, in your paper, you present this shift from the place-based predictive policing to person-based predictive policing as something that should be striking or noticeable to, or is worth paying attention to. But just in my mind, I was wondering whether aren't person-based risk assessments very common and old hat? I mean, isn't this really what is at the heart of predictive targeting of potential terrorists? So you've the equivalence of heat lists there. And also, I mean, isn't the insurance industry just in general based around predictive assessments of individual risks? So, you know, when you refer to this, the scientific basis for this, is there not a long history of person-based risk assessments?
I think that there has been a growing use of predictive risk assessments in terms of how we have targeted terrorists overseas. And obviously there is an insurance risk as well. We haven't done it in policing. And in fact, there may be real concerns, even the sort of analogy that, oh, right, we are going to use the same tools we use to target terrorists in our own citizens is something that should at least create a few red flags. But it's actually true that the technology, the underlying technology, in many ways has come from our use in our sort of international intelligence agencies that has been adapted to recognize that the interrelations and the social networks of terrorists, not too dissimilar to the social networks of gangs. If you can do it if you can map terrorism connections, so you can use that same technology to map gangs in inner cities. And so it has happened. That has been done. It's certainly not the advertising campaign because it would create a lot of fear, I think, among the citizenry. But in terms of the technology, I think it is the same technology. It just is that police and policing in America has largely been reactive for a long time. The sense is, you know, the police will respond to an emergency, they'll respond to a crime, they'll be out patrolling. If they see a crime, obviously they would act on it, but they're not going to go out and target people because they think someone might commit a crime. And they certainly, at least before this sort of project, weren't necessarily going out and knocking on people's doors and giving them literally a letter that says, we're watching you, this is what we know about you, and this is why you should stay on the right path. It's not that, again, it's not that that's an irrational idea, right? It is adopting a public health approach in the same way if you knew that smoking causes cancer and you knew people were smoking, it makes a perfectly irrational idea to knock on the door and hand them a anti-smoking brochure to say this is a risk factor in your life. You should choose not to smoke because of X, Y, and Z. That makes sense, and they're adopting that idea. The only sort of underlying question is, you know, when police are doing it and when it also involves sort of social control and social surveillance, it has an added sort of civil liberties concern that these people, these young men on the heat list are being targeted.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could definitely worry about there being some sort of veiled threat or coercive element to that public health role, particularly when you point out as well that, you know, the other social supports that were supposed to be in place to make this an effective public health type intervention haven't really been there, that the social services haven't kind of matched with the predictive policing techniques. Just one final question before we move on. I mean, how different is this as well from, you know, classic approaches to policing that I would have heard about years ago in relation to New York, like the broken windows style of policing? Is the predictive policing model or approach different from that?
It's a different theory. The broken windows approach was essentially trying to affect quality of life, environmental concerns, the theory being that those kinds of broken windows would attract crime. This is both focused on places. So I guess, you know, if you see a broken window, you put a police car there and that will deter future action. Again, like from a deterrence rationale, that makes some sense. If you think that a particular area is going to be the focus of burglars going back, putting a police car there will deter them. It might make them go somewhere else, but if you're just trying to stop the uptick of burglaries there, again, it makes perfect sense. It also ties in with the idea that underlying a lot of these criminal actions is something in the environment. To me, the great insight of predictive policing, and I'm sort of agnostic about the technology, it is what it is, we can debate what people do with it, is that it really gives you insight into what's going on in the environment. The question of remedy is different. Like, what do you do? You don't have to put the police car there. You could fix a window. You could build a social services center right there. You could do lots of things with the same amount of money to address the underlying environmental risk. But the nice thing about predictive policing is it's identifying those risks. It's trying to show you where in a community there's something going on that's encouraging either crime or violence or some combination thereof. And that's, I think, an insight worth not losing with the concern and debate about whether predictive policing is good or bad or fearful or something to be feared of, something to be feared or something for the future.
Yeah, I think that's a point well taken, and maybe we'll get back to that as well. But as you point out, the identifying the risk factors by itself is actually a very good thing to do, assuming the risk factors are true or are truly indicative of a higher risk of criminality. And then what you do in response to that is a separate question. Now, in your paper, the main focus of the paper is really on identifying and discussing 9 vulnerabilities to predictive policing, the things that we need to think about and consider responses to if we are to implement this technology any further. Now, we won't have time to go through all 9 of these vulnerabilities, I think, but let me just list them at the outset. So the 9 vulnerabilities are data, problems arising with the data that these systems use, the methodologies that they use, the underlying social science that they rely upon, their transparency, their accountability, their practical implementation, the way in which they change the administration within police services, the underlying vision of criminal justice policy that they have, and then also the data vulnerabilities or security vulnerabilities within them as well. What I'd like to do is maybe discuss a few of those. I'll try and focus on the ones that are mainly have to do with policing itself, because some of those vulnerabilities just arise from any big data system, but some of them raise specific issues when it comes to policing. And let's just start with the issue of data vulnerabilities. So what are the data vulnerabilities that arise from this technology?
So there are several. Some of them is as basic as how you collect this information, right? So imagine you're a police officer on the street, you're doing your patrol, you see someone you think might be involved in a drug deal, you chase him 4 blocks away, you tackle him, you grab him, turns out he does have drugs, that's great. Where did the crime occur? Where do you put down the data of where the arrest for the drug crime? Was it where you first saw him and you thought he was doing a drug deal? Is it where you tackled him 4 blocks later? The reason why that matters is that the insight of predictive policing is it's supposed to be pretty granular, right? And so if you have information that is sort of fuzzy, you might be targeting the wrong block. Maybe you ran into a nice block, but that's why you wrote it down. Or maybe when you're the police officer and you wrote it down wrong, or you forgot what address it was, or you transposed a number. So you have all these like human issues with it, of sort of the collecting it. Then, of course, you have to input it, and you have to have it inputted in a way that, again, avoids error and the rest of it. It has to be uploaded into the system that exists. It has to be cleansed if there's ever problems with it. And you have this in every city. In America, we have, I think it's close to 18,000 different law enforcement agencies. Most of them don't share any system or any similar technology. So you have a very fragmented system. So even in, a few big cities have enough data to really collect, but many don't. And so you have pretty small bore systems, fragmented nature, so you can't really change. And then you have the reality that a lot of the data is, or some of the data is coming from where police are, right? So if you put police in particular areas and police make stops in those particular areas, those might become the areas you think are higher crime, but in part it's because that's where you put the police officers. And had you put them somewhere else, maybe those would have been the higher crime. So there's an element of bias. We've seen in the last 2.5 years a very robust discussion in America about the racial bias of our police forces, some Department of Justice investigations into police forces that have actually demonstrated a chilling degree of racial inequity. And so you have all of these data problems that are you're being used to build your system. And since the system is simply the data, in some of them, simply the data collected and then crunch and then spit out again, if your inputting is messed up, your outputs are going to be messed up, and you're not going to be able to really rely on the data. So that's just some of the reality of, you know, policing is not a data pure profession. It's very human. It's done by people who didn't go into the profession to be data collectors. And there's a lot of mistakes and a lot of concern with it.
Yeah, I mean, so there are a lot of things going on there. One of the big ones, which you touched upon there towards the end, is the potential confirmation feedback loop. I think this is a term you use in the paper itself. How these systems are used to police and target particular areas, maybe usually areas with racial minorities in them, which results in more data being collected from those areas, which in turn predicts the likelihood of more crime or more criminal activity in those areas. Could you maybe discuss, is this a real concern, a serious concern about these systems? And actually, another way of phrasing the question would be that, are these systems really a mask, or provide a mask for racially biased policing?
They can be. And this is why I think it's really important to focus on the type of system you're looking at. So there have been a couple of sort of high-profile media reports about looking at how if you just built a system based on police arrests, you would be only reifying the racial bias in policing patterns, which I think is actually accurate. If you were only looking at where police are arresting people, you are really just predicting where police have been policing. A couple of the companies in Predpol, which actually has been taken to task on this, I think unfairly, would respond to say, look, we don't base our data on arrests. We look at calls for service. Who called to say their house was burglared or their car was stolen? Pretty objective factors there, right? And if we're just using those factors as our input, we are responding to where the crime occurred, not where the police were. But they're different systems, and different companies are using different systems that can sort of bake in some of the policing patterns and unfairness in the system. So I think it's something that needs to be front and center in the focus of police administrators and cities who are adopting this technology to be aware of it. It doesn't mean that you have to write off all predictive policing as racially biased, but you certainly have to be concerned of it. In fact, just as some background, so the 9 points that I sort of write about in this paper were an effort to sort of think through ahead of time what administrators need to think about before adopting this. What do you need to have answers to before you're adopting it? The same reason I wrote my book is try to give people sort of the tools and the framework to analyze it beforehand. And it's not simple. People like the simple answers. And it's very complex because you can do this right and you can do it wrong. And you need to be careful about not only doing it right at the front end of sort of designing a system that's not going to replicate policing bias. At the same time, you have to keep checking it too, because there are interesting internal pressures. One of the things we saw in New York City when they began their sort of data-focused CompStat administration was that, you know, when crime comes in, there's a lot of subjectivity to determine like what level of seriousness. If you want to have your arrests go up but your crime rate goes down, there's an incentive to sort of minimize the kind of crime while at the same time keeping your arrests high. And there's a real incentive for the numbers to be massaged. And when they did some audits of the New York Police Department, it didn't look too good. There were some problems in it. So that's a concern with the data about how objective it really is.
Yeah, there's this well-publicized report released by ProPublica about machine bias in these predictive analytics technologies. So it's from May of last year, I think it was released. Mm-hmm. And I'll put a link up to it on the website that accompanies this podcast. But I mean, do you have any comments on that? I mean, are there specific cases where we've shown some clear bias against somebody for racial reasons because of the reliance on these technologies?
All right, just for some background and clarity. So the risk assessment analysis that the ProPublica folks were analyzing involved a pretrial release risk assessment. So you get arrested, you come in, and the court system, both before they release you and then when they sentence you, wants to have some sense of whether you are a safe risk or not a safe risk. And the algorithm that was being used and being studied by ProPublica was deemed to be sort of racially discriminatory because the factors that they were considering were really socioeconomic factors, which correlated with race and poverty. And so there might be, you know, a young woman who was 18 but had no stable family and no job, changed in school, and she was rated as a higher risk than a 40-year-old white guy with two prior felonies, but he had a job. And so depending on how you weighted it, she was deemed higher risk than he was, even though when they then studied it 2 years later, it turned out that he, being the felon, committed another felony and she was fine and hadn't done it. And so there is a real concern. There has been some pushback on that ProPublica study. And there's an interesting, I can send you the link to it, interesting sort of response to it that said it's not the algorithm that's so biased, but it's the fact that, you know, our society is pretty, in America, is pretty socially, economically divided, and that the algorithm is sort of adopting these other inequities, and thus it's sort of spitting out this inequity. So it's saying it's not the algorithm is biased, it's the underlying socioeconomic reality. I don't know if that's any better, really. I mean, that just sort of shows that in a world that isn't fair, the algorithm will also not be fair, and that to me seems to be a problem. But I think it's a concern. My hope in having this conversation both about predictive policing but also about risk assessments in general is saying that we can't be fooled by the idea that because it's math, because it's numbers and objective, that the underlying racial and economic inequities in our society somehow go away. They don't. They can be addressed, and you can develop algorithms that are actually trying to deal with these at the front end, but not casually forget or be lured by sort of the siren song of big data that somehow we are moving away from the reality we know that policing embeds itself in.
Yeah, I think it's important here to bear in mind what the existing status quo is, and whenever we're considering the implementation of a new technology or a new innovation, we have to think about whether it improves or disimproves things relative to that existing status quo. I think that's a point that's well taken. I just want to move on then to actually the methodology questions here, because this is one thing we didn't really discuss in the original run through the technologies and the history of the move from predictive policing 1.0 to 3.0. I mean, are these techniques actually proven to be effective? Do they reduce rates of crime?
Yes and no. There, if you're talking about predictive policing 1.0, there has been so far really one peer-reviewed study that has done it. It was a peer-reviewed study that was done by the founders of PredPol, so you have to take it with a grain of salt. But they looked at a comparison between their algorithm and the crime analysts in LA and the crime analysts in Kent, England, and they found a statistically significant improvement in using their algorithm over the crime analysts. It's one study. It obviously was over one period of time. There have been a few other studies. RAND Corporation did an independent study in Shreveport, Louisiana, looking at an algorithm they created that was sort of based on predictive policing 1.0, and they found no statistically significant improvement. There's anecdotal evidence, both pro and con, that this helps police sort of redo their staffing and has lowered crime rates. But this is one of the problems with methodology, right? It's difficult to show cause and effect. And the crime rates in America have gone up and down. That seem to be somewhat independent of either policing staffing levels up and down and even the economy up and down. We haven't seen, despite political rhetoric the other way, we've seen pretty much dropping across the board. And we've seen rather dramatic experiments in New York and other places where we have incredible sort of stop and frisk policies of 600,000 people being stopped a year. And then now it's almost, down to under 100,000, I think. And crime's only continued to go down. So it may have less to do with policing and more to do with other economic and environmental and social realities that's affecting it. So one of the difficulties is being able to claim that predictive policing works. And that is an open question. Now, that open question should give people pause, but the strange thing is it hasn't really given people pause, and this is why I think it's such an interesting story, is that the idea of having this black box solution to crime is so attractive that whether it works or whether it's just better than what you had or whether we'll see what happens has been enough that people have been putting, cold hard cash into these systems to move forward and be at the forefront of predictive policing in America without even knowing if it works or not.
Yeah, I mean, you're a little bit more careful about the methodological problems in the paper, I mean, in identifying specific ones. But, I mean, one of the things you mentioned there is just the difficulty of actually knowing what the background crime rate is and being able to determine whether there is any improvement or disimprovement. I mean, why is it so difficult to know what the underlying base rate of criminality is?
It's because we don't have great data on the actual realities of crime. You know, lots of crime goes unreported. There's a Department of Justice study in America that says sort of 50% of crime is unreported. Some of it is perhaps more obvious. You have sexual assaults and interfamily cases that aren't reported. Some gang violence isn't reported because they take extrajudicial means. But lots of people, even with property crime in certain neighborhoods, feel that it's actually more of a hassle than it's worth to call the police and bring the police into your lives. In a world where people are undocumented here in the United States, there's lots of crime on people who are vulnerable because they don't trust the police to come in. And so if you don't know the base level of crime, it's hard to know whether crime is going up or down. It may just be the reported crime. Again, that's in some way why the predictive policing 1.0 sort of stands the test better, at least for certain property crimes like burglary, car theft, theft from auto. There's this insurance background where people tend to report it because you can get the money for the stuff that's been taken. Not always so in assaults, not always so in other cases. And so there has been a better reporting with at least in certain areas and certain sort of economically stable environments, people who have insurance for their house and their car, to know what the base rate there is and thus be able to determine whether crime has gone up or down for those particular crimes. But much harder for other kinds of crimes and much more difficult in a world where we are, you know, again, very fragmented in our policing data collection and our policing structures. You know, after the series of shootings of unarmed African-American men, you know, the Attorney General of the United States had to come up and say, we don't actually even keep track of the number of people who police shoot or even people who shoot at police. So as a data collecting system, we are rather behind the times here in America.
Yeah, I mean, and one other thing then about fragmentation. As you mentioned, there are 18,000 different police departments.
Almost
18,000 in the U.S. So, and obviously they're dealing with very different geographical and sociological areas. So there's a huge problem here as well with generalizing from particular studies in particular regions to the nation as a whole or to policing as a whole.
And that's a real concern. So a lot of the studies have come out of LA because LAPD has actually been at the forefront of trying to experiment with new technologies. And LA is LA. It's a huge city. It's a very spread out city. It is a place where, you know, 500 by 500 square foot block can be sort of determined to, you can see why. If you take that exact same study and analysis and you put it in New York City, which is built vertically, right, where there are thousands more people in each block than there are in LA, it may not work. And then if you go out into the sort of rural areas or even the suburb areas where you have, you know, smaller towns with fewer people, and yet you're applying the same predictive technologies, there's just nothing to say that what works in LA will work in New York, will work in Reading, Pennsylvania, will work other places. Now, the technology is being adopted there, but the studies that everything's based on just haven't been validated in those other areas.
Yeah, and then another point here that you raise has to do with the error rates associated with these technologies. So, I mean, any predictive tool, any diagnostic tool has an error rate associated with it. It carries a risk of false positives and false negatives. And obviously this can be a serious issue, particularly if we're, let's say, involved in person-based predictive policing when we're targeting individuals. There's a danger that we pick them out falsely as being, you know, potential risks or potential criminals. And this might, you know, impact upon their civil liberties in a negative way because of this error rate fallacy.
Right. I mean, so the Chicago Tribune did a story when they were sort of investigating the HeList of a young man who had the experience of a detective knocking on his door to say, you're on the list. We've been watching you. We want to give you a chance. And he was sort of puzzled because he had one misdemeanor conviction, nothing big, wasn't involved in a gang, didn't necessarily have any real ties. And he asked him, like, why am I on this list? Why am I one of the, you know, 1,400 most wanted or whatever, most at-risk people? They said, oh, because your best friend was killed a year ago in a gang shooting. And so you got put on. And you could see from his perspective, on one hand, that does answer why, you know, if gang violence is retaliatory, why you're on the list. But on the other hand, suddenly your victimization, the fact that you are a victim, you lost someone you cared about, has now put you in the crosshairs of the police without the asterisk that this is a victim rather than a potential perpetrator, can cause real concern. And he felt chilled that this idea was that suddenly he's now on the list. So when a police officer sees him or sees someone who's actually is thought to be violent, they're seeing the same, you know, risk factors, that there's a real problem, both in terms of the accuracy of the system. Like, maybe they should differentiate between those people who are most likely to get shot and those most likely to get to shoot people. But also what would happen when he runs across a police and the police are like, oh, you're on the heat list. Well, now we're going to treat you like a suspect because everyone on the heat list, you know, is obviously more at risk of being violent than other people who are not on the heat list.
So I think you make a good case here for there being these methodological problems with this technology. So from a policy perspective, what do we need to do to prevent these from becoming too serious? And how can we improve the quality of this technology?
I mean, it's hard because we don't have control over the technology. The technology is being created by private companies that are selling it. Many of the algorithms are secret, they're proprietary, so we don't even know. You can make educated guesses about what's involved, but we actually don't know what's behind it. And so it's difficult to make claims about what should be done when there's very little, currently very little public discourse about it. So for example, what happens is you have a series of companies that are sort of competing to be in this space. You have a series of cities that are bidding out and trying to find what works for them. And very rarely, with a few exceptions, and now Oakland, California, and Seattle, do you have communities weighing in about whether they want this or not, what it means for, you know, racial relations, what it means for policing practices, whether it's a good investment of the taxpayers' dollars. And so there isn't, at this moment, much discussion or space about how these things can practically be examined or sort of looked at ahead of time. And in fact, and this is sort of, you know, just a reality, you know, the reason I wrote this article was because I kind of got tired explaining what predictive policing was to people who called about it and what they should be worried about. I had begun my sort of academic approach looking at the law of it, the Fourth Amendment. I'm sort of a constitutional guy, right, about the Fourth Amendment. But I kept getting the calls like, how should we think about this? What do we need to ask? And so this article and the book are sort of ways to get people to think about it ahead of time because we're not having that conversation. We don't know what to do now, and there isn't even a space for us to do it.
Yeah, and I mean, what you're saying there really touches upon the next two vulnerabilities that you talk about in the paper, which is accountability and transparency. So you've just really identified the issue with, let's say, the transparency of this technology. Now, there are many reasons why the technology might lack transparency. Some of it could be because it's proprietary software and it's protected through a network of secrecy laws. I think Frank Pasquale has written quite a lot about this and quite perceptively. One of the things I'm interested in is the extent to which this technology is intrinsically opaque because of the way in which it relies on machine learning statistics. Mm-hmm. And then this has a knock-on impact on the accountability of police services. So, you know, there's no reason why you would be familiar with the situation in Ireland at the moment, but there's a lot of scandals around the accountability of the police service and the way in which they treat whistleblowers and who's responsible for various things within the police service. An increased reliance on this technology could have serious knock-on implications for the accountability of the police to the public, right?
I think that's true. And so just to go back to one piece on the transparency, so as these technologies develop and machine learning and artificial intelligence really comes to the fore, we are going to be in a world where we can't be transparent because there won't be anything to look at. It'll just keep changing because the data will keep changing and they'll keep sort of recycling the last data. So we couldn't even go back and audit it because the information will have changed. And that makes the whole idea of transparency very difficult, like maybe practically impossible. So we have to think about ways to at least hold people accountable, even if we can't understand the math and be able to explain it to people about why it is happening and what is going to happen. In terms of accountability, my hope is, you know, what has happened is that the technology has evolved. It has come from companies, it's come from government, it's come from the war on terror and the rest. And it is happening, as it usually happens, through acquisitions and through procurement, right? In a weird way, that's not necessarily the public discussion. And my hope is that with more thought about it and more discussion about it, we'll be able to get it away from procurement and acquisitions and into democracy and political accountability of our local communities. Like, there's a real question of, like, should you pay, you know, $60,000 to a predictive policing company, or should you take that same money and invest it in schools or after school programs or whatever? Can you really justify the use of this in an accountable fashion? And that we just haven't had that conversation yet. And thus it runs the risk of there are big companies chasing policing administrations. And so there's room for, you know, corruption, there's room for lack of accountability, and there's room for the slickest, you know, company to win the day, even if they're not providing the best product.
Yeah, but maybe it's important not to be overly negative here as well, because you do make a comment in the paper that there are ways in which these data-driven systems can actually foster greater accountability within policing. So maybe talk a little bit about that positive aspect of this technology.
Sure. I mean, you know, so the beauty of any data-driven system is you can see how it's working, whether it's working, and study it, right? So you can go back to look at it to see if it is doing what they said it was going to do, and if it's going to work. So, for example, in the sort of early rollouts of the heat list, you could go back, and they've tried to do this to check to see, okay, we predicted these people to be at risk. Were they at risk? Now, the first iteration, Rand did another study and actually found out that that didn't predict anything, unfortunately. But Chicago changed the system, and now they think it's more accurate. But you can go back and test to see if it works. And what you're doing is, at least, is you are trying to figure out what are the places and or people and or environments that are sort of creating crime. And if you study it long enough, you'll realize that you actually can at least figure out what the patterns are and see the patterns. And the beauty of data, which, you know, or sort of a data-driven world, is its ability to allow visualization of something you might know, but when you see it in data and you see it in mapping, it changes the way you view it. And that's actually, I think, one of the hidden insights of all of this. Is, you know, police have always known there's crime. It's not like that was ever a surprise. But actually seeing the visualization on the maps of where these people were, places were, and then studying, well, what else is on that map? Why is it there? Why are we going back to this place over and over again? You can figure it out. You could ask any local police officer on the beat, like, who are the bad guys in your neighborhood? And they'll tick off the list of the people who they know. But seeing it is as a reason of, like, you know, all these people share the same, you know, five factors. They all, you know, have, you know, this gang affiliation. They all have dropped out of high school. You know, seeing that and visualizing those patterns really does create insights that you might not have gotten in the ordinary course of policing. And I think that's a real value to this. And I, you know, that's why predictive policing and big data policing is going to continue. It's just a question of how we sort of think through these problems as it continues.
Okay. So, I mean, one thing that you're raising there about how police get to use these technologies and how it changes their perception of what they're doing, I mean, even though they may have had intuitions or beliefs that about the level of criminal activity or the factors that are predictive of criminality before, seeing it in the data, seeing it in the technology, changes how they interact and implement their policing practice. And that's another one of the vulnerabilities that you talk about in the paper. So could you maybe discuss the way in which this has at the moment already changed the way police interact with the public and what the issues that arise from that changed interaction are?
Sure. I mean, you know, metrics matter. Every employee and police are no different than anyone else, are going to respond to what they're being asked to do on a daily basis. And if their supervisor says, hey, we want you to patrol the little red boxes that the companies have given us to say are going to be predicted crime, that's what you're going to do. And what has happened in the rollouts of LA is they found that police were doing that, but actually doing it maybe too much. They sort of stay in the little red boxes and not leave the red boxes, even though the official rule was that they were supposed to go there after they'd done their other shifts just to spend extra time there. But what happened was they kept spending their time. In fact, some of the there was a quote from a police information officer who's explaining why this city was knocking its predictive policing was they said essentially LA had to come up with a tag phrase saying think outside the box because all the police kept hanging out in the box and weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. Otherwise, there are other issues, problems of so you're told by as a police officer, look, go look at this particular area for particular crime. In the Shreveport experiment that Rand did, the police officers actually got out of their cars and started being investigators, which on one hand was good. They started figuring out what was going on in the neighborhood. On the other hand, was bad because they stopped responding to the emergency calls. So they got all these complaints that they weren't doing the basics of, hey, there's an emergency 911 call. Why are you out there playing detective? And ironically, the detectives weren't terribly happy that these patrol officers were playing detective because they kept being given clues without a case or an open case or a helpful case. And so the interest in the area, which was legitimate because the police were told to go look at this area, distorted the ordinary roles of policing. Now, there were positives to it. There was more community engagement. The community actually started understanding what police were doing. And so it's neither good nor bad. It's just distorting. It changes the way police are doing their job. The perceptions, of course, of an area might affect what police do. You can imagine if you're told that a particular area is known as a high violent area for shootings, and you're an officer, you'd be wise to be wary in those areas. And so you might treat people with less openness. You might be more defensive and protective of yourself. And that can create additional tension in the ordinary course of police-citizen interactions. And you can change where people go, right? I mean, literally the areas where police will patrol will be based on the metrics of what's being asked. Did you go to the boxes? Yes, I did. And it might mean that other places that deserve policing aren't getting the same level of attention because the algorithm didn't tell police to go to that particular neighborhood at that particular day.
Yeah, and what you're pointing to there actually are these are problems that we have with technology in general, that they change the way we perform tasks, and oftentimes we're guilty of maybe what's referred to as automation bias, that we accept the recommendations or the constraints that are imposed by the system, and as you say, we don't think outside them. I think that's a very important thing to bear in mind whenever we're dealing with a technological innovation, that we don't use it in a thoughtless manner, in an automatized manner. I think actually you do mention automation bias at some point in the paper itself. Right. Yeah, moving on to some of the other challenges and vulnerabilities then. You discuss administration, that this involves the centralization of administrative power within police forces. I'm just going to skip over that in the interest of time, and I want to move on to how this maybe changes the vision of policing and what policing is supposed to do, and the ways in which it might create a certain arms race between the police force and criminal activity and change the way criminals respond to policing as well. So maybe you could discuss those changes in policing that result from this system.
Well, so there are two parts. There's one is the vision of how police become more proactive as opposed to reactive, right? And that's a structural change that we've seen. The sort of buzzword of proactive policing has been going on for over a decade, where this idea of being able to identify patterns and respond to them has been a controlling factor in policing before predictive policing came out. So that's a big change. In the vision question I ask is I try to take a step back and say, well, let's think about what we're doing with this technology and whether we're doing enough. So, for example, one thing that we do when we're focused on identifying where crimes are so that we can use it for a predictive algorithm is only focus on the crime. And that's missing some of the picture. The other part of the picture you may want to know is, where were the police when the crime happened, right? We have wonderful crime maps in America that show all the particular crimes during the time, where it was, over time. But we don't have those same maps of where the police were at that time. Like, were the police a block away? Was there something blocking them? Were they just not in the neighborhood at all? Why was that? What were the paths? And we actually could do that now with the technologies that, hey, we have GPS on our cars and our body cameras and our smartphones. We have that information. So a vision question that is open is, why don't we really think about not just where the patterns of crime, but the patterns of policing and crime, and being able to sort of map those completely? We haven't done that because, you know, there's some social surveillance, some worker surveillance of policing that might cause a backlash. But we haven't really done it because it hasn't been our focus. There's another big question is, why are we focused? You know, I sort of joke that, you know, predictive policing is great, except for the policing part, right? We do real risk assessment, real analysis of where the environmental factors are. But then we have a policing remedy, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? If we know there's crime here because people are poor, and because there are thefts that people need to steal cars in order to survive, we don't have to put a police car in the block to stop that. We could also fund the social services that cause people to need to steal cars. And it's about a cost benefit of which ones we want to pay for and how we're paying for it and who's getting the money. But that is a choice. That's a vision choice, that we want to invest in technology to track crime and prevent crime, as opposed to dealing with the underlying failures that are causing crime in the first place. That's a vision issue. And then the final sort of vision question, which again is it's another article I'm working on now, is whether you can turn the sort of architecture of surveillance that we've done a great job of building on citizens against the police. Right? So here you have a reality where we can watch citizens in many urban areas through networked video cameras. Every license plate comes through. We can, you know, look at what you're saying on social media. All those technologies could also be turned on police to see if they are obeying the Constitution. Are they treating people with dignity? There's some really interesting studies out of Stanford. Jennifer Eberhardt there has essentially studied what the Oakland Police Department has done for 2 years, looking at the language used in their body cam. So they basically digitized all the body cam conversations to see if they could determine whether police treated people of different races in different ways. And they created an algorithm that they could actually predict with pretty certainty whether the officer is talking to a person of color or a white person based on the terms of respect. And that's also all using sort of like just digging into the data. They're able to look at the patterns of using handcuffs as an indication of whether people or Afro-Americans were treated more violently than whites. And it's all about sort of using the same architecture of surveillance that we normally use on citizens, but use it with police, and to make sure that we can hold police accountable for their jobs. And these are some of the ways, as we're developing the technology, we can choose, go through the path of full accountability or not, using the technologies in place to improve training, improve services, and improve accountability for how police treat citizens.
Yeah, it strikes me that in some of what you're saying, there's a hint that even though we've made the shift towards using these technologies to have these more dynamically updated predictive systems, we are nonetheless trapped in an old mode of policing, which is, you know, send the patrol car to the area and try to knock on doors or prevent people from committing crime, when we could be using the same data sets to in more inventive or creative ways. And we're not capitalizing on the shift in data collection powers that has taken place.
And some people are. There are certain experiments that are going on. In the book I have a whole chapter about sort of entitled Bright Data, about how you can use the same big data technologies to sort of improve things without the police. And there are people who have recognized this insight and are trying to do the same sort of environmental risk assessment maps, but focusing on non-policing remedies. And sometimes they're combined, where the city will say, this is great. We realize that police are just one tool in a larger a set of tools we can use to deal with the underlying issues. New Orleans has actually been pretty innovative about adapting sort of the predictive policing model, trying to do the predictive policing 3.0, the heat list idea of identifying the people who are most at risk of violence, but then actually building out social service programs and funding them and trying to address the underlying causes in a really holistic way. They partnered with Palantir. They partnered with, you know, all of the big data companies that, you know, got their start sort of tracking, you know, terrorists. But then they have built from that a social services model where they're actually saying, you know what you really need to do? You need to have better lighting outside, you know, the fire department, because the kids, as they walk home from school, walk right past here, and we can change the environment here. Or what you really need to do is being paying attention to these risk factors, but then have people who can intervene before the shooting. We know on Twitter that this stuff's about to fire up between Gang A and Gang B. We can have people who can go there and stop it. We can do it in real time, and we can use this new technology to sort of intervene. It doesn't have to be the police to arrest everyone. It can be sort of the social network in the city to sort of take some of these same bright data ideas and apply them. But it costs money. It costs, you know, someone has to be visionary. Someone has to want to say they want to do it. And sometimes it's easier to sort of fall and just, you know, sort of slightly upgrade your technology rather than really rethinking how you're doing it.
Yeah, just finally then, before we finish up, we may as well address the issue around security, since it's obviously going to be a major issue here. If the police are collecting lots of information about us, about our activities, and even if we're collecting information about them, and they're using this to predict future behavior, there's a risk here about that these systems are hacked or that there are leaks of data. So, I mean, discuss some of the issues that arise there and how they could be addressed or resolved.
I think that we are really in the infancy of thinking about security from the police aspect. I think for way too long, you know, the police have been focused on collecting information about other people. And because it's through the public role of surveillance and legitimized by law and their authority, they haven't really thought about, you know, this data might be valuable for other people who could break into our, you know, usually you don't think about breaking into the police department to get information. But that is going to be a very valuable commodity, A, for sophisticated criminals who want to sort of outthink the police and try to get around the police, but also just for other, you know, people who want to cause disorder and the rest of it. And so I don't think that we have really paid attention to security risks of the data that's being collected by the police. And certainly they'll have, you know, the basics of it. But I don't think it's been either financial in terms of what the money we're paying to sort of secure it, or even conceptually that this is really a risk. That, what do you mean, you know, if you think about it, everyone knows that every police station there are weapons and guns. But it's pretty odd to think that someone might break into the police station to steal the weapons and guns. Sure, it could happen. But of all the places, why would you do that? But I think that, and I think that mentality is happening with data. People are like, well, why would they break into our place? Well, you know, we're the police. We wouldn't do it. But I think that eventually when these data sources that will include not just, you know, public surveillance, but also private data brokers, which sell their information to law enforcement to collect, these creations of dossiers where we're being able to sort of predict who the targets are going to be, it's going to be a ripe environment for people either who just want to cause disorder or who want to get a competitive advantage in the world of criminality to break in. Like, if you knew the policing patterns of where they're going to go every day, that might be helpful, I guess, if you're a criminal trying to, you know, stay one step ahead of the police. And so I just think we're at a moment where the security risks, as they are everywhere, are real, but I'm not sure police are paying attention to what they have to do to secure theirs. With the final, you know, just caveat being, in most of these situations, we're not talking about, you know, Google and IBM and like really wealthy jurisdictions. These are police departments and cities that have to pay for gas and insurance and everything else. And the idea of building, you know, really sophisticated security upgrades to protect against the possibility that someone might hack into them just isn't the top priority. Like, you'd rather hire another officer or buy a better police car. And so I just don't think we've really come to terms with the risk there, because we haven't had too many bad situations. I don't think we've had any real scandals occur yet.
Yeah, I think the fragmentation of the police force is also an issue there as well. I mean, if you had maybe more integration between the different departments, they could band together to afford a more comprehensive solution to the security vulnerabilities that they might have. I mean, where do you see this technology going in the future? This is here to stay, presumably. Is the future dystopian or utopian when it comes to the implementation of this technology, or is it just naive or silly to ask such a question?
Well, so I think that the risk identification potential of big data policing is a real positive. That what we're doing is using, perhaps the same insights we've always had, but being able to quantify it and look at and study the patterns to see what is causing crime, how crime is developing, where are the patterns, and then being able to address it. I think there's a real concern with thinking that police can solve that predictive policing really requires the remedy of a policing solution. Because I think we might be able to step back and say, from a city perspective, from a government perspective, there may be better solutions there, right? In the same way, you can have a heat list of your 1,400 young men who you think might be involved in crime. You could send a detective there, but you don't have to send a detective there. You really could just send the social worker there. You really could just send the employment person or a mentor there. You don't need necessarily, even though the problem is where the funding comes from, you don't need the policing to be there. I think that the danger will be is that because the idea of predictive policing is seductive, because it seems futuristic, and because we've never had a good solution to the problem of solving crime, except for the obvious one, which is like to give people jobs and education and opportunity and love and something to look forward to in the future, because that's too hard, we have decided to think technology will solve it. And I think that in a world where there is a fear of crime and a fear of gangs and a fear of the other, that this kind of predictive technology will be attractive enough that we'll see more investment, the technology will be cheaper, it'll be easier to adopt, and we'll be seeing more and more of it across the country and the world, because this is an international thing. These companies are selling it internationally. So that this will be, we are at the very beginning of a change in policing that will only grow as the technology gets more sophisticated and people get more comfortable using it.
Okay, thanks for joining me today, Andrew. Just before we wrap up, I mean, I'll include links to the papers that you've written on this topic with the post that accompanies this podcast. Tell me a bit about this book that you're working on, The Big Data and Race. When is that due out?
So I have the final edit to be copy edited to send to my editor this week. I should say today, but it'll be this week. And it will be out this year. It's being published by NYU Press, and it's called Black Data Policing, Big Data Surveillance, Race, and the Future of Law Enforcement. And it really tries to show how this idea of predictive policing, predictive analytics, big data policing is changing how we police, who we police, when we police, and where we police. And then looking at some of the other ideas of, are there insights to sort of solve social problems through bright data? Can we create better policing accountability mechanisms through blue data? And the whole book is brought together around the metaphor that all big data policing has a black data problem. Black in that the technology is opaque and we don't understand it because of transparency. Black because in America it's racially coded and caught up with our history of racial discrimination. And black because it's distorting of the law. We haven't really talked about it here because it's more technical about the Fourth Amendment. But each one of these big data technologies changes the constitutional protections of American citizens in cities everywhere, and the law hasn't caught up. It's been distorted by these new technologies. And it's kind of black because it's cool and techno-friendly and everyone loves the next new thing. And so there's this idea of playing with this idea of black data policing to understand and try to conceptualize where we're going in the future.
Yes, you got nice multiple meanings to that phrase, black data there. I like that. So yeah, that sounds like something that's to look forward to. Again, I'd just like to thank you for joining me. I think this has been a very fruitful and interesting discussion on predictive policing and the vulnerabilities and future of this technology. Thanks.
Thank you.